kids are Friday, and you got big plans for the weekend, Shannon? You going out, figure skating or duck hunting or?
Oh, no. It's we're getting ready for the garden. Oh, it's going to be garden time, you know?
You
got the shovel in the dirt.
You find this exciting, do you?
Oh, you know what, Bob? After all these years, I grew up on a farm and I hated it.
Oh, really?
I hated it. Oh, I hated it. I mean, my older brothers used to call me Gentleman John because they would, you'd have to go change the water or pick the fruit or, I despised it. So I would find an excuse not to do it. But I love tinkering in my backyard because the plants don't talk back. Nobody argue when you're in the backyard and you got your shovel in the dirt and you got the plants, nobody argues with you. And it's fantastic.
Well, let me know what gardening day is, and I'll come over and solve that problem for you.
Every day is gardening day, Bob.
My gardeners were here this morning. So as close as I get to gardening. I watched them out the window. I think we're going to have a fun hour or a little less than here today. We've got two of the two hockey broadcasters in this country, with due respect to anybody I'm not thinking of, but these are the national play-by-play guys, both on. I've talked to both of them over the years, but never together.
Well, they rarely work together, right? They're rarely in the same room.
No, well, but I never, even in a broadcast, in a show that I've done, I've never had the two of them on at the same time to kind of discuss these kinds of things. So we're going to talk about being a hockey play-by-play guy. Jim Houston and Chris Cuthbert, side by each, on the broadcast today, will commence after these messages. And off we go. It's McCowan, it's Shannon with you on this Friday as we bring the week to a close. And what better way to do it when the two most prominent hockey play-by-play guys in the country, Jim Houston and Chris Cuthbert, both with us simultaneously. And I can't, I have to take the opportunity to, with both of you on here. My first question is maybe an obvious one, but everybody that gets into this business grows up having listened to somebody else and maybe not patterning yourself after them, but that was kind of the reason why you went down the road you went down. It's different for me, not a play-by-play guy, but I'm very intrigued by who your influences were especially before you got into the business. Chris, I'll give it to you first.
Well, good to be with you guys. Good to be in the same room with Jim, because that rarely happens for play-by-play guys. We're always somewhere else in opposite rinks, but nice to be with you. For me, it was going to bed every night with a transistor radio under my pillow and listening to Dan Kelly at KMOX or Foster Hewitt on CKFH or whoever was calling that game. And often on a Sunday night, it might even be Bob Cole on CBC Radio with the Sunday night game. And, by osmosis, I think those gentlemen and Danny Gallivan on Saturday night television, by osmosis, you pick things up. You certainly shouldn't be copying any of them, but certainly influenced the way I called games. And I'm going to steal some Jim Houston thunder, but I think I hear Jim Robson a little bit when I listen to Jim Houston.
True. Oh,
without a doubt. Mentor and a great friend. So when I was in high school, I had a part-time job at a local radio station in northern British Columbia. And one of my jobs was in the summer when the BC Lions were playing, or in the winter when the Canucks were playing. This radio station was on the network that carried the Canuck games. So I would sit through the evening, and my job was to plug in the commercials when the network went off to a commercial. So I sat and listened very intently to Jim Robson as he called all the games. And then later I got a chance to work with him. My first job in the NHL was to fill in for Jim on the radio on Saturdays when he worked at Hockey Night in Canada. So that's how I got my opportunity to work in the NHL. And as Chris mentioned, you automatically copy some things if they're good. You know, like I still I have a book, and we all, as play-by-play guys, usually have a notebook that we lay in front of us. I still lay it out exactly the way Jim Robson did his, because I looked at his and thought, that's perfect. Why would I change that? Why would I just do that? And then the obvious influences of the people who worked the national games. Danny was always an inspiration to me because I got to know him, and he was such a wonderful guy. And the way he called the game. One of the things that I learned from Danny was that there was never a bad game. When he called the worst, he could make the worst game come to life. And I always thought, just because it's a bad game, there is a redeeming quality, and you got to find it somewhere.
You don't write as small as Robson, though, do you?
No, and not as legibly.
Oh, I tell you, Jimmy had the Jimmy all those years. I'd see the notebook, and there is not a chance I could read a sentence in that notebook or a number in that notebook.
And John, you couldn't read anything in mine either. But the key to writing things down is retention, you know, because you never really look at it. But I still, on the left-hand column of my little notebook, I still put, and this is a Robsonism for sure, what the weather was like in the city I'm in that day. 15 degrees and cloudy.
What's the relevance?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. But he did it all the time, and I started doing it. And then you can become a creature of habit.
Like, sure.
It's got to be there or I'm not prepared.
Buddy, I used to love listening to Danny give the weather. He'd tell you what the weather was like in Montreal on a certain game as well.
Yeah.
Did you guys grow up wanting to be play-by-play guys? Because I mean, it's a part of broadcasting, but it's such a unique part. Or did you just want to be on radio or on television? Which was the case, Chris?
I think I did want to be a play-by-play guy. I'd be in the basement no matter what time of year, baseball, football, hockey, and I guess looking back on it, I realize now I was hanging off every word. And I do remember turning off the audio on the television for some CFL games. I was a big Ottawa Rough Rider fan, and I remember calling plays as a kid, but at the same time thinking, there's no chance this is ever going to happen. Those guys are the luckiest guys in the world. They're special. I'm not. This is not going to happen. And not till university, when really my job options were almost nil, at least I felt like they were, did I have the audacity, I guess, to take the full plunge into it. And I was lucky enough at university that they had a radio station that did play-by-play of university football and hockey at Queens. So I got some practical experience that very few people at that age would get. So I was lucky.
Huey, were you bent on being a play-by-play guy?
No, not at all. I was going to be an actor. I was in the theater department. And then I realized when I went to university how little it paid. But I'd had a part-time job at a radio station. So I go back up to this small radio station in Fort St. John in northern British Columbia. And the sports department consisted of one guy, and he was the director. And
of course.
And as is the case in most of those small radio stations, everybody's looking for a job somewhere else, trying to move up. And he moved. And I was the only guy left in the radio station who knew a puck from a football. And I loved hockey. I mean, I played it every day. I was still, at that point, I was still playing on the local junior team. So I took over and started broadcasting the local senior games and just sort of muddled my way through it. And it looked like, at that point, I thought, geez, this might be the ticket to $50 more a month. And that's exactly why I moved on to Penticton and Kelowna and Brandon, Manitoba, and places like that. And I just kind of fell into it, but certainly got a passion for it. And then when I got a taste of what it's like to do an NHL game, that sort of sealed it for me. That was going to be my vocation no matter what.
The fascination of that is that where Chris grew up in suburban Toronto, in that with that transistor radio, you could pick up 6 or 7 or 8 different NHL games a night.
Yes.
You, Chris or Jim, you got one.
And we had no TV. Like we had one channel on TV, right. And we didn't get all of the Hockey Night in Canada game, but right. We had what we had, John, in small town northern British Columbia were the Fort St. John Flyers, who were the greatest team I'd ever seen play. They played in the Southeast Hockey League. And if I wasn't at the game watching them or scraping the ice in the intermission when I got old enough, I was listening to the game on the radio at the local hot stove league. And I loved it. And it was, it was local culture. So my love of the game and initially of listening to broadcasts came locally, because that's the only option we had. The only other radio station I could get is in the midnight, lying in bed, I could listen to CFUN in Vancouver, and I'd wake up in the morning and it would be gone and squawking.
With Jim Houston and Chris Cuthbert. So I've never really added it up, but I think I've done over 10,000 broadcast shows. I have never once listened to a tape of myself. And
not even the podcast?
Why would I listen to this? You're on it.
See, I just set you up every time. I just give you the line. And
thank you. Would you come out to the golf course next time I play and put the ball on the tee too? I'm having a little trouble bending over at this age.
Well,
so the point of the matter is that I don't think that's normal. I'm told that that's not normal. That most people who are broadcasters do go back and listen to themselves in an effort to understand what they did and make corrections. Are you those guys? Jimmy, I'll give this one to you first.
Yeah, I do that. And not for obvious reasons. I don't want to say, how did my voice sound tonight? No, that's not it. I always ask the question at the end of the night, did we tell the story of the game? Then listen to the coaches and the players and see if what I saw and what we said collectively on a broadcast and how we analyzed it jives with what they felt. And just to make sure that the story was told. And the other thing is I've found over the years that if you listen back and watch back, you correct some redundancies.
Sure.
Pick out little things, the crutch phrases and things like that, that bother the heck out of me. And I like to eliminate. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, that's I listen less and less because I'm never comfortable, and I don't know about you guys, but not even comfortable with the sound of the voice. But I do want to eliminate those crutch phrases, and I've found I'm very grateful for the 1 hour summary broadcast now, because I don't have to put up with myself as long, but I'll often start maybe 10 minutes and then enough of that, but I do want to pick out not mistakes as much as you start getting into a habit of calling the same play the same way all the time, and I once was given an article about improving your writing, and it talked about pulling the weeds out of your scripts to make it read better, and I find it's the same thing. I'm looking for weeds to pull out of my next broadcast.
Getting from point A to B in the fewest number of words and being explanatory. And the other thing when you watch back is that you don't need to watch the whole thing. You can spot watch it because you know exactly after the game which part you want to see and you want to hear, because you know the parts that you don't need to go back and watch the parts and listen to the parts that you thought were okay, because something will come into your mind and say, we messed that up. I got to listen to it.
Yep. And the oldest adage though in broadcasting, and it is a cliche, but it's true, is it's never as good as you thought and never as bad as you thought. And I refuse to watch the 2010 gold medal game because I don't want to hear any mistakes. I have a good feeling about that game, and I just want to keep it that way.
Yeah, good.
John, jump in here.
You know, it's funny because the two people that got mentioned early as the mentors, Jim Robson and Dan Kelly, were two polar opposites for that very reason. Jim would lament over every word, every game. I mean, having worked with both of them a lot, Jim would come out of the booth and I would be higher as a producer. I would be higher than a kite because it was a spectacular game. It was a really good broadcast. And I'd say, great game, Jim. And he said, you know, at the start of the third period, I think I said Gradin rather than, you know, Eldebrink. And I would turn and look at him and say, Jimmy, come on. Nobody noticed. But it was, but Jim was such, so meticulous about his craft. Dan, on the other hand, you'd walk in and you'd say, hey, Dan, great job. Yeah, I know, we were fantastic, weren't we? and these guys were, these two guys were polar opposites.
Yeah.
Polar opposites of how they viewed their roles, the game. And it's fascinating to see that both of you guys have picked opposite guys to say that those guys are the driving forces.
One of the lines I learned from Jim Robson very early in my career was usually by the first commercial break, his line would be, there goes the perfect broadcast.
All right. Without being specific, because we don't want to embarrass anybody. Part of the job of a play-by-play guy is to work with a sidekick, a commentator. Have you had guys that were difficult to work with? Have you had situations, I assume you've had situations where the two of you weren't in sync either for a night or for a long period of time? Tell some stories. Names are not necessary.
Well, I've got one that immediately comes to mind, and it's an unusual one because I was the color guy, and John might remember in Washington, Molestar or Canadian Sports Network or whatever it was at the time, was asked to help out with the Washington broadcasts. And for a year, they sent Danny Gallivan. But the next year, I think they put it in the hands of George Michael. And I went down to be a color guy. And George Michael basically introduced me to the game in the 15 minutes in the lead up, telling me how bad Danny Gallivan was as a broadcaster. And that was not going to work. And it was an uncomfortable night. I think it was my one and only color game as a Washington Capitals broadcaster. But that didn't go well.
I was actually, that. Go ahead, Jim, go ahead.
Oh, because I worked with the same guy. I got, and in my time at Canadian Sports Network, I was in that period of time too, where they had this agreement and his show, George Michael's Sports Machine, was like huge in America. Yeah. And so he was this iconic figure that I didn't really know, because in those days, I mean, when did I see Sports Machine? Not very often, only if I happened to be in the United States. And so I had a very similar experience, but sitting beside a guy who really didn't want me to be there, and just talked over everything. And it was like, I got a word in every 15 minutes and that was about it. But for the most part, in up here, I've been so lucky with great guys to work with all the time. It's wonderful when the person you work with every day also becomes your best friend, as I have with Craig Simpson, for example. And never have I worked on broadcasts where all the cabs go with one person in a different direction at the end of the night. Fortunate that we all go together.
We just to finish the Washington story, I was a little involved in that stuff. And David Poyle, who was the manager there at that point, came and said, you know, we really need to improve our television broadcast. Can we do anything? And a group of us came with the idea, well, you know, Danny could paint a picture. Danny would be great. Danny was also winding his career down with our company. I don't think he knew that at the time, but he that was a reality. And so we thought if we put Danny in there, could Danny reinvent, that style of play-by-play in Washington, for a year, to help the club. And it was an unmitigated disaster because the American hockey fan could not understand what Danny was doing. Now, this was in the '80s. The interesting thing is that in many ways, Doc Emmerich,
I was just going to say that, John. Yep.
Doc Emmerich's style it was so much like Danny's. And I do think that Doc kind of patterned himself after Danny a few times. For a guy in his 70s, Danny was actually ahead of his time in Washington. Everything you talked about there, the Washington experiment for the year was just, it was a painful, painful night. Now, this was a year where we did a lot of games in Washington, 25. We didn't do every game. It was only one game a week, but it was a painful, painful experience when we tried to do it with Danny and with the Caps.
As a non-play-by-play guy, I'm intrigued by the word style, and it's come up a few times here in this conversation. So I am nothing more than an observer of what you guys do with no background skill set or whatever. But I'm intrigued by the word style. What exactly is a style for a play-by-play guy? Jimmy?
Whatever you fall into, whatever. You know, so for a long time, I used to get, and still do actually, get young aspiring play-by-play guys would send me tapes and ask me to, you know, critique this and go over it. And I would meticulously go over it with a fine-tooth comb and give them direction about which style you should use here and what verbiage you should use here. And then as I evolved myself and started, you know, busily working on my own game and doing that, I thought, you know what? I'd listen to everybody who does games in the National Hockey League, and there's no right and there's no wrong. There's the way you find to do it. You know, there's no voice that's better than the other. It's the voice that the fans trust. It's the voice that you grow comfortable with. There are guys who for 30 and 40 years, if we went into the style book, if you will, just break every rule, but are beloved in their communities because they are the voice of their team. And So what's wrong with that? So the style is what you find that works. I find it, you know, when you've got to be cognizant of the game. And for me, I'm working national games all the time, so there's always two teams in the game, which isn't always the case if you're a local broadcaster. And I'm okay with that. So style, it's what you find that works for you.
And it might be our own ear or our own interpretation. I always thought Dan Kelly was technically the best because he just seemed to be, I can't even describe why I thought that, but Danny Gallivan was the artist. He added that extra to it. There's a derogative saying about some play-by-play guys that they're just bingo callers, and it really is a bare bones thing, which I don't even think that's wrong. I think sometimes I've worked with a couple producers, and I'm not talking about you, John, but they want to keep you in place by saying, you're just a bingo caller. But I will tell a story from my very first game and I think John was, I think you were in the truck. I actually, my whole goal in my career was to work on Hockey Night in Canada, and my mind has gone completely blank on my first ever call, but it was Quebec and Calgary in 1984, and I got through it. And 2 days later, I got a call from Ralph Mellenby, and it wasn't very complimentary. He did concede at the end that it sounded okay, but Ralph had laid out this new agenda for the young upcoming play-by-play guys that he wanted more conversation. NBC was also big on this, even 20 years later, that they talked a lot about, we want conversation, we don't want a traditional call. And so I think there's been a push probably that started in the 80s and it still continues about that mix between bingo call and conversation. And I'm still working on what the right combination of the two is.
I hate to tell you, Chris, but it was 4-4. It was at the Saddle Dome. Quebec and Calgary, Charlie Bourgeois scored a goal late in the game for Calgary to tie the game. And it was an electric night at the Saddle Dome because the Flames had come back to win. Your point about Ralph was very accurate, but we were also changing the whole concept of what a color man was. And it affected both of what you guys were doing, because we were going from, in those days, Dick Irvin as a color man, Brian McFarland as a color man, and whether it was Howie or even Babe Pratt or even Ted Reynolds in Vancouver as a color man, we were going to former players. And so Ralph wanted to bring a lot more of the why to the game. And the only way to bring out the why with the players early on was for the play-by-play guy to ask why. Because the player, it was just not in their mindset to explain stuff. And that's why that happened. But I remember the game. I remember most games, but I remember that game for you, Chris, simply because it was such an exciting night. And I remember you coming out of the booth saying, boy, I'm not sure how good I was, but I had a great game to call. And that's what made that first night for you exciting.
Just an inside on the, what I do remember is 2 days earlier, the Flames had played and you had brought me in early to watch that game. And I walked by the studio that night and was introduced to the new host of the midweek Calgary Flames games, a guy by the name of Ron McLean. Small world.
I'm always astounded with these conversations of people remembering things from 20, 30, 50 years ago. I can't remember what I did last Tuesday.
We did a podcast, Bob. We just did a podcast. That was it.
That may be the least significant thing that I did, but I can't remember anything else about it.
But and when it's 40 years ago, you can make it up.
Sorry, say again.
That's true.
No.
When it happened 40 years ago, you can make it up, and nobody, who's going to call you on that? Who's going to say it's wrong?
They can find it now. You guys would call me on it if you were there, because you remember. Yeah. And I have absolutely no recollection of any show I've ever done, really. In a generic sense, sure, but in a specific sense, none whatsoever. I finish, it's over, it's out of my mind, and you guys can point to specific things that happened. I find it astounding.
Bob, I will tell you, I get on Twitter, people will send me links to former broadcasts and on YouTube, and I'll put it on just to see what it was or for 5 minutes. And honestly, there are games that I do not remember I called. Yeah. I called one of two, was it Jeff Fry hit for the cycle for the Blue Jays? And it's only happened twice in Blue Jay history. I had no recollection of that. And I should have, I don't know why. Wow. And there's some playoff hockey games. Oh, I was there. So, yeah, I think because you do thousands of games and you're cramming for that night and then you move on to the next game, sometimes the memories aren't as good, but other things just stand out forever.
Go ahead, Huey, quick.
I was just going to say, I thought I remembered vividly my first ever game, National Hockey League broadcast, and it was on the radio. And it was in 1979, and I picked the date and I got a researcher to find the game sheet, and I was looking at it and thought, yep, that's the game, only to have Jim Robson say to me, no, I did that. And then tell me, no, that was in October. Your game, your first game, was in December. And here's where I thought I had it nailed, but I was 3 months off.
Oh, that's a great story. I'm glad I paused there. We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back. Jim Houston, Chris Cuthbert with us this time. Back after these. It's McCowan and Shannon with Houston and Cuthbert, who need no further introduction. We were talking about play-by-play becoming more conversational, which is tougher to do with hockey because it's moving all the time. I mean, do you guys remember Phil Rizzuto on Yankee broadcast?
Oh, yeah.
And how, I mean, you could watch 10 minutes and neither with a play-by-play guy nor Scooter would tell you anything about what's gone on. They'd be telling you stories about going to the grocery store before the game or the kids yesterday or, you know, my new car or whatever. That's much, that you can do that in baseball and especially on television. How much different is it doing radio versus television for the play-by-play guy? I know there's the obvious, but tell us about that, Chris.
Well, I was going to defer to Jim here, because I think baseball is unique, and I didn't feel I could ever be a great baseball announcer, because I didn't think I was steeped enough in the sport to, and I guess I would have immersed myself, but Jim did, and he did an outstanding job at it. You know, hockey doesn't give you time to be too much of a storyteller on exactly. TV. I would think it would give you much less on radio. And I've done very little radio play-by-play except at the tier two junior level. And that was when I was getting my feet wet. And that was a bingo call back then for the most part. So I'll give it up to Jim here.
In the days of the, in the 80s and into the early 90s, when the games were 4 hours long, you could tell a few stories because there was always a long period of time where they were cleaning up helmets and gloves and sticks off the ice. And so you'd have time. The game is so fast at this point and happens so quickly. And it's not unusual for there to be, in each game that you do, periods of time where there's 6, 8, 10 minutes without a stoppage in play. And I always say to guys that I work with and producers who say they want more stories and things like that, well, if I launch into a story and the Leafs score a big goal, or somebody, you know, scores a big goal, or there's a big moment of the game, we lose the story and we lose the moment.
Right.
And you don't want to do that. So, you know, I think you have to judge the game. You have to judge where the game is at, what the just like players, coaches are always saying to players, come on, watch the time and score. And then, and what you do changes depending on how much time is left and whether you're leading or behind. And there's, you know, how many goals are differentiate. You do the same thing in our position. You have to pick your spots, and sometimes you pick them and sometimes you don't. It's like the face-off, where you decide to say three more words and the puck's in the back of the net.
Everybody's touched on the fact that you guys have done other sports. Jim, you did the Jays with Buck for 5-6 years?
Yeah, was that right? About that.
Okay, and Chris, obviously, you were obviously the voice of the CFL for a long period of time. If I could have walked in and said, by the way, you're never going to do hockey. Jim, you're going to do baseball. Chris, you're going to do CFL. Would you have been satisfied with your career if you just had maintained your play-by-play in those two sports? Jim, you first.
I guess I could have been satisfied with it. But given the option, I chose hockey. When I'd done a number of years of baseball expos and Blue Jays, it became very apparent to me that it was becoming a time to choose, because the crossover season was becoming almost unmanageable. Mm-hmm. The workload was really high. I could handle it. I had a young family though, and I was thinking, you know what, I'm going to have to make a decision. And when I made the decision, I chose hockey because, yeah, for some very different reasons. Yes, I love the sport. I felt that I'd spent my life around it, and I really felt immersed in it, but I also felt like I didn't want to work all summer long. I love baseball, but they insist upon playing every day all summer long.
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do.
And part of the reason I chose hockey is because of lifestyle. And so it was, you know, those are the things that come into a decision like that. But it did become clear to me that I would have to choose one or the other, because the crossover seasons were unmanageable.
You know, for me early on, I at CBC, you were responsible for certain number of, you'd have a winter sport, you'd have a summer sport, amateur sport. I think I called 13 different sports, and I love the variety, and I for a while I seemed to thrive off of it, but the longer I got into it, the more I wanted to be just good at one or two things, and I actually felt like there wasn't much more I could do in football. I'd called all the Grey Cups, and I didn't think my broadcast was going to get much better than, not saying it was perfect. I just didn't think I could elevate my game to any different level. And I still felt like feel like hockey is a challenge to call. And I wanted to kind of give it my undivided attention before my career was done, but and you're seeing fewer and fewer guys who had the luxury that a lot of us had, and nobody probably was better at it than Don Whitman at doing
right.
a number of sports exceptionally well at the same time.
You guys, I think everybody knows, are now calling games, not being in the arena, but off a monitor. Everybody in the world is, I guess, really.
I think these
that.
Guys are in no, the. I think when they do a games, they're in the arena.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Haven't done a game off a monitor yet.
I think I can credit Jim for that because he put it. He was the first voice of not opposition, but pleading that we got to be in the rink, and I echoed that, and I think we're pretty lucky that we've been able to be in the rink since last spring or last summer, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I apologize for that suggestion. I just I'm operating under the assumption that everybody is working remotely. And I was going to ask you what that process is like and how difficult it is, but I guess that would be an irrelevant question for two guys that still go to the rink.
No, what I'll tell you though is I've got great respect for the guys that have been doing it because for a lot of them, the fan at home doesn't know. And it's a challenge. It's not easy. It's not the best way to do it. But Jim, I think a lot of our colleagues have done an outstanding job from remote locations.
Fabulous. Because I know. Just because of the scheduling, and I can look and see, you know that, for example, this season, all of the regional broadcasts, the away feed is done remotely. And so I know that going in, an audience may not know that, but I sometimes have a tough time picking out things that would be obvious to me that would tell me that they aren't in the building.
Me so too.
A lot of guys are doing a really good job of it. We have a lot more cameras now. We have a lot more monitors. The last time I did it, I had one single monitor in the room and was just following whatever feed was there. I think there's a little more technical support to the way they're doing it, but guys are doing a terrific job of it.
Well, it raises the question, and I guess that was my previous question was the precursor to this. Are we going to see this happen on a regular basis? Maybe even a permanent basis, the ability of broadcasters, play-by-play guys to work remotely and still provide an insight, relatively speaking, the quality of the broadcast sounds like they're there. Is this the wave of the future? And do you fear that?
I do. I fear it. I hope it isn't. I think at the production level, and John can speak to this more than we can, but I think there'll be less production travel. The truck might be replaced by remote or control rooms back at plants. But you know, there's something special about, and the one thing we've all missed is calling games with the crowd. And the crowd for me is not like an analyst, but it's almost like another part of the broadcast that you can use when you're in the building, when you sense that wave or crescendo of audio that's happening or that's coming, or you can anticipate or you use, and it's all part of the broadcast. If we've missed that, then we need to get that back. And if you're sitting in a studio, I don't know how you can take advantage of that. And I don't know if the bean counters are going to identify that as essential, but for Jim and I think it is.
They will win that on some levels, I'm sure. There will be levels at regional broadcasting. There will be levels at the national broadcast level where there's a few games where I think that the production will be done remotely. Maybe not with the announcers, but I agree with you, Chris. And I think that what I've really missed here in the last couple of years is the sense of event. Because to immerse yourself, like I just say, what I miss more than anything is when the Stanley Cup final is on and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock and you're walking through the streets of Boston over to the TD Garden because there's a Stanley Cup final where the cup could be presented tonight. For me, that's a part of what I'm doing there. That's a part of immersing myself in the event. And it's walking out of the arena afterwards with thousands of people out on the street enjoying what just happened or forlorn because of what happened. And it's what's the celebration that's going on inside. And if I'm sitting in a monitor thousands of miles away, I haven't got any feel for that. I think it's a really important part of what we do.
And the interesting thing is that North America is late to this dance.
Yeah.
As you guys know, this is a fact of life in the rest of the world. When you have one feed and 17 languages in Europe, nobody's there. They're all calling it in a booth in their home country. And it's been that way for decades. And no better example than that, than most world hockey championships or Olympics. It's a fact of it's a fact of life. The other thing is, and you touched on it, is one of the reasons it's going to happen is because the broadcasters did too good a job.
Yeah.
And in many ways, with the passion that you guys have and that every play-by-play guy, whether it's John Shorthouse or Rick Ball or Jack Michaels or Dennis Bayak or all the other guys, Dean Brown and the guys in Ottawa, they've done it too well. And the bean counter and the president of the network and the executive producer, they don't notice a difference. And so why would they send them? They've done too good a job. It's a typically Canadian thing. It's a typically Canadian thing for us is, well, we'll just do it. Well, they'll slog through it. Life will be good. And okay, that's going to be the way it is from now on.
I texted a couple of my friends the other night when I was watching a game and said that very thing to them as they were calling the game. I said, you guys are too good at this. You're never going on the road again.
Yeah.
That is the answer. I think that's the correct answer, and that's the future. And how far it goes just remains to be seen, and how quickly we get there. Shockingly, the time has expired for us, and wish that we could sit and chat for much longer. But hopefully, you'll both be kind enough to come back at some point in time, and we'll continue the dialogue and actually maybe talk about the National Hockey League. We didn't really do very much.
Why would we do that? Why would we do that? Come on,
something to do. Maybe so I can get you to ask a question rather than...
No need to chat any longer. You won't remember it anyway.
I'm sorry, your name was again? Thank
Bob,
you, boys.
It's been a pleasure. Just a reminder that John Shannon is to blame for both of us. So
absolutely.
I'll leave on that.
Thank you both, guys. And continued success. All the best. And we'll see you down the road.
Don't worry, boys. I get blamed by McCallum for lots of things. So...
Real pleasure, guys. Take care.
Thanks, guys. And good to see you, Jim. Cheers.
Back after these messages. I do have a habit. I guess we all have habits of, at this point in the program, thanking the guest or guests who were on. And I'm certainly inclined to do that with our guests today, Jim Houston and Chris Cuthbert. But it was intriguing for me as a guy who's been in broadcasting all my life, but never really been a play-by-play guy, to listen to these guys talk about their experiences, what they do, what they're thinking of, all of this kind of stuff. And you're a guy who's worked with them. Like, their first day was almost your first day, isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm lucky enough. I was there a little earlier and quite frankly, was part of the management group that brought them to do hockey on television in our country. So we're great friends. We enjoy each other's company. There's, even if you don't see a guy for 6 months, there's a nod or there's a text and you pick it up where you left off. But they do have such different styles. And I think we even in the storytelling we got today there, you got a sense of there's a little more theater in Jim. Well, Jim wanted to be an actor. And there's a little more ancillary information from Chris, because quite frankly, he had to, and I think he admitted it too, that he had to work around a business that expected you to have a big voice. So he had to deliver more information first. So, but both are great listens. They understand the game, and they also realize that in the end, they are not the story. The story's on the ice. The story are the 40 players playing the game, and their job as play-by-play guys is to make the viewer at home, the listener, more excited about the 40 players.
About a minute and a half here. Was one of them more difficult to deal with than the other?
Those two? No. They're well down the list. They are, and I think because as the business changed, they came in the early 80s. And I would tell you right now, people that started at that period of time had a better comprehension of the team, of how it worked, particularly guys like Jim and Chris. They understood that they were part of a team. There were others prior to that that worked in the business of being the single voice for a game. And I don't mind saying, guys like Bob Cole and Dan Kelly and Danny Gallivan, when they started in the 50s, they were a single voice in the booth with a microphone.
Right.
So it was just them. And they never got out of feeling that they were impresarios. Chris and Jim were team players. The other three I just mentioned, they were more like impresarios. So it was more about, I've got to be great, and then the rest will fall in place.
Well, and they all speak highly of you publicly. Privately is a completely different situation.
Publicly,
well,
yeah.
That's what I said.
Just publicly.
You know, privately, well, you know, I can tell you horror stories, but nonetheless, that is for another day. Our thanks indeed to Houston and Cuthbert for joining us. Y'all have yourselves a swell weekend. And if the crick don't rise, we'll see you on the Monday. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.